You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 2nd to the 8th of March 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter John Elms and deputy news editor John Morgan. If Brexit leads to a mass exodus of top scholars from the UK and intellectuals disillusioned with the US under Donald Trump opt to flee the United States, where will they go to? David Matthews and John Elms have co-written this week's cover feature, and Mr. Elms will provide some insight into what that article found in just a moment. Now, is anti-right-wing bias endemic in universities? And how does that sit with the shift to the right that we're currently witnessing in Western politics? Not only in the cases of Trump and Brexit, I might add, but also with far-right candidates riding high in the polls in both France and the Netherlands ahead of elections there. Mr. Morgan has been assessing the picture in the US and the Netherlands, with key political figures in those countries challenging universities to prove that they are indeed offering students sufficient diversity of political perspectives. And later in the podcast, we'll hear from Valerie Ashby, Dean of Trinity College of Arts and Sciences at Duke University, who's been speaking to us about increasing the diversity of PhD candidates. But first, John Elms, over to you. The cover feature this week looks quite simply at whether scholars might be tempted to flee the UK and the US following changes there. You've conducted surveys, you've been speaking to other countries as well, Ireland, Australia, about whether they might be the places they choose to go to. What have you found out? What's this feature all about?
Yeah, well, as we all know, the world has gone through quite a dramatic shift politically in the last, year, I suppose it is now almost. Following the EU referendum and the election of Donald Trump. And at Times Higher, we've obviously looked at what these kind of things will mean for the UK and the US sectors, and whether the result of Brexit and Donald Trump's election will result in academics who have, I know, become disaffected by the changes or feel that they're going to be slightly, I suppose, victimized is the wrong word, but you know, their situation might be more difficult in employment following these events,
or indeed just kicked out for not being British.
Oh, quite exactly. That's also a consideration, a very strong consideration. I mean, that's an extremely worrying one. And we've looked at the countries most likely to see if they would take advantage, as it were, of this potential Brexitus, which we've so wonderfully coined a word.
You use the phrase "take advantage" there. It sounds very cutthroat, but these days, I suppose, in academia, one sector's misfortune could be a real opportunity for another sector to reap the benefits, bring in some top scholars.
Absolutely, quite. I mean, I think I should stress that especially with Ireland, the people I spoke to in Ireland, they were obviously thinking that as an EU member state now there would be a number of academics who would want to come to their country, but they didn't want to seem as though they were exploiting the misfortune of the UK. They did, a lot of people I spoke to did specify they wouldn't want to do it to the disadvantage of the UK, but obviously it does represent an opportunity for them because they have access to EU funding, which is there's a strong possibility that UK academics won't. I mean, take the case of Ireland. It's obviously an English language speaking country. It is now and some of the institutions in Ireland are high ranking English language speaking institutions, which represents a very easy kind of transition from the UK. Also, geographically, it's very close. One of the key draws, I suppose, that most of the people I spoke to a couple of heads of institutions there, Andrew Deeks at University College Dublin and Patrick Prendergast at Trinity College Dublin. They both mentioned the fact that even though Ireland has just come through an age of austerity, a period of austerity, science and research funding was maintained in that period. In terms of Australia, we have very similar academic systems. There's quite a few UK academics who've already taken the plunge and gone to Australia. I spoke to the University of Wollongong's Vice Chancellor Paul Wellings, who went to Australia in 2012, and he said, very similar HE systems, an English language speaking country too, and a more agreeable climate might be might be draws to the country, and he'd also noticed a spike in interest to his university from UK academics.
What about them though? Are they being proactive? I remember a big advert in Times Higher a while ago from universities in Ireland trying to tempt people over. It's all very well saying, you know, it's a good fit on paper. Have they actually sort of recognised this fit and put some money behind it to try and get people tempted?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, going back to Wollongong, Professor Wellings, Paul Wellings said that, you know, he had run a series of advertorials through the THE, in fact, saying, you know, after the in the 6 months period after Brexit, saying, look, we're here, we have if you're looking to explore research opportunities and research role opportunities in our country, please take it up. Other universities have done the same, and he said he could be really surprised if further institutions wouldn't do similar things. And also, Ireland's Higher Education Authority released a report at the end of November saying Brexit and Irish higher education and research challenge and opportunities, saying that the nation should act as a talent magnet, attracting the best academics and researchers. So there are signs that people are doing things, obviously in the context of we don't know what's going to happen with Brexit and or Trump. Those are some of the things I can draw out.
Very good. Well, you can read that feature on page 34 this week. You'll also find it on timeshighereducation.com. On a similar theme, John Morgan, your splash this week looks at the sort of anti-right bias or alleged anti-right bias within universities, but not just anyone saying this, some fairly significant politicians, quite key people, raising concerns about the diversity within universities, particularly from a political perspective.
Yeah, we've had some quite significant developments on this in recent weeks. For one thing, Betsy DeVos, who's Donald Trump's education secretary, a little bit of a fire under this issue in her speech at the CPAC conference, which is the US's biggest conservative conference, and sort of after addressing conservative college students in the audience, she said that the faculty, from adjunct professors to deans, tell you what to do, what to say, and more ominously, what to think. And over in the Netherlands, there's been a motion passed in the parliament, initiated by an MP from the centre-right party that leads the government, and that calls for the government to ask the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences to hold an inquiry into whether conservative academics and universities are feeling they have to self-censor themselves, and whether there's a limitation on diversity of political perspectives. Basically, the implication is they want to ask the question whether liberal universities are biased against conservative academics. Mm. And I spoke to Peter Duisenberg, who's the Dutch MP who proposed that motion, and it was interesting that he said he put forward the plan after being approached by conservative academics who felt discriminated against, and also by developments in the US, where you have that debate about supposed liberal bias in universities is long-standing and is now intensifying. So it's interesting to see that he was directly taking up that debate from the US. So the question looking at in the article is will the culture wars approach to universities spread beyond the US as it becomes more and more intense in the US under Donald Trump?
And you've got elections due in the Netherlands, which we've heard about, but also France. That phrase culture wars is quite a strong phrase. Where did that come from?
So one of the people I spoke to is Andrew Hartman, who's author of A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. And he explained that universities have been a particularly important site for the culture wars traditionally in US culture, because of, you know, since the 1960s, a college degree has been sort of integral to individuals' economic success. And in the past, the Republicans saw that the humanities as key to the health of the nation and wanted to try and win those back from the left. But now, perhaps a couple of things that might intensify things under Trump. You've got scientists sort of increasingly drifting leftwards in recent decades, and now you've got a president who has expressed the view that climate change is a hoax, and possibly now the Republicans have moved towards a stance where they're likely to advocate cuts in subsidies for humanities, or possibly stripping them of public funding altogether. So those are a couple of ways in which the culture wars in universities might really intensify.
Well, given some of Trump's promises in his recent address, the cuts have to come from somewhere to fund what is a very ambitious scheme, and of course THG will watch closely to whether that axe falls anywhere near higher education. Before we go, we'll now hear from Valerie Ashby, Dean of Trinity College of Arts and Sciences at Duke University, who's been speaking to our reporter Jack Grove. He asked her about the challenges of getting black women like herself onto PhD programmes and ultimately into positions of academic leadership.
As you said, the numbers in the pool are still small. Yeah. And with all of the efforts that have happened to increase the number of PhDs graduating who are underrepresented in the sciences, still, the numbers in the pool are often very small. So we have to be intentional. So we've recommended to some of our science departments to take a look at the graduate students who are in their fourth and fifth years. We start earlier.
Yeah.
At conferences, amongst your peers who you know have great graduate students, and we start recruiting those folks and following those careers earlier than one might think you would have to do for normal faculty.
So how early is that? That's
a year or two before they're graduating, okay. And they will often go to a postdoc,
yeah,
after that.
Yeah.
And so you start tracking them early,
yeah,
and introducing them to Duke and what Duke has to offer early. And that often is where we will get success. So in our last cohort of faculty within Trinity, we brought in 15 faculty and 4 were African American, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. We still want to do better, but it's, yeah, pretty good. So what's key for me is now for those young people, I say young people because they're younger than I am,
yeah,
but for the new faculty who just came in, they must find a place where they are committed to stay.
Yeah.
Right. So they must find an environment where they can get their work done, but where they are supported, where they are encouraged, where they are valued. So
do you think having good role models is important?
It absolutely does. So, you know, I did not appreciate that as much as,
yeah,
since I appreciate it more since I have been at Duke.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of what we've been talking about here, all of my mentors are male. And one of them is African American, and I of my 4 that are my key mentors,
yeah,
I have 3 white men and,
yeah,
1 African American male, which is totally fine. It,
yeah,
has worked for me. But when I stepped on Duke's campus, what I immediately realized that people cared that I was a woman, people cared that I was an African American woman, and then people cared that I was a scientist, and it matters to students. I have more students who approach me, you know, underrepresented students,
yeah,
who really want to talk about their careers or what their plans are, and I think they feel a low barrier because they think that I'm going to be able,
yeah,
to relate to whatever their situation is. I feel this with female faculty. They are drawn to me, which I love that. But I did not imagine when I took this job, I was thinking about doing the job.
Yeah.
Wasn't necessarily thinking about, you know, the role that I would,
yeah,
play as far as a role model,
yeah,
for women or for minority students or for scientists.
Yeah.
But it does matter. It lets faculty, staff, and students know that diversity is valued, and it gives people a role model, and it gives you someone that who looks like you, who may have had a similar experience.
Yeah.
That's encouraging.
Thank you for listening to this week's THE Issue Review podcast. That's all for now. You can discuss anything we've discussed online. You'll find us at timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and on Twitter. However, that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.